I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Ask most people how they feel about the government and businesses collecting and using their personal information, and they'll tell you they don't like it. And yet, we give away a lot of data about ourselves when we swipe our credit cards or conduct Google searches or use GPS, loyalty cards, EasyPass. And it turns out a number of our devices are, quote, watching us as we use them. It's been 3 years since Edward Snowden blew the whistle on the NSA, revealing the extent of data surveillance by the federal government. And yet this issue has gotten little traction this campaign season. Well, today on Radio Times, privacy, technology, convenience, security. We have two guests who have joined us. Adrian France is a staff writer for The Atlantic, covers technology, and joins us by Skype. And Adrian, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Robin Green, and she's policy counsel for the Open Technology Institute. That's at New America, specializing in issues concerning surveillance and cybersecurity. And Robin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much.
Adrian,
glad to be here.
Oh, nice to have you both here with us. Adrian, let me begin with you. There have been a number of polls over the last couple of months asking people how they feel about data collection, either, I guess, business or government. What are the feelings, I guess, and it seems like there are multiple feelings that the public has about this.
Right. I think we've seen over the past few years even that people are uneasy about how their data is being used, and yet that doesn't always translate into changing their behaviors. So, for instance, people might not like the idea that Facebook has, to use one popular example, that Facebook has all of this data about them, but the trade-off of giving up all of that access to friends and family or, you know, other social networking just isn't enough to prompt them to stop using the service. So people don't like it, but they oftentimes will still be using these services anyway.
Because it's convenient, it's in your pocket or in your pocketbook.
Right. And also just if it's the place where all of your friends are, or all of your family members are, it's sort of hard to, for some people anyway, to walk away from that.
To you, Robin, does privacy even exist online anymore?
Oh, absolutely. I think that privacy is something that people think about a lot. I think privacy is something that when you talk to folks in the government, they look to how individuals share information online and say, oh, well, Americans don't care about privacy anymore. But the reality is that privacy is about autonomy. It's about having the freedom to choose what information you share with whom and when. And so Facebook is a great example of people deciding how they want to share their personal information. You can choose to share it with friends. You can choose to share it publicly. I do think that there is an issue that needs to be addressed with regard to, once companies have information, how can that be used? And clearly, Americans have shown some unease about how that information is being kept and used and further shared. But I do think that at the end of the day, people care very deeply about their privacy. It's why there was a huge backlash some years ago when it came out that our iPhones and Google Maps could actually track our location. That's why there was such a backlash to the Snowden revelations, and why we now have things like Do Not Track and other types of privacy protective choices that we can make in all of our social media and other types of services that we use online.
Adrian, I'm curious about whether the public people make a distinction between if it's the government that might be tracking us or getting our information versus if it's a company or a business or something like Facebook.
Right. That's a good question. And I think part of the thing is we don't actually always know how that data or information is being shared. So, you know, even if you look back pre-internet, there were decades in which phone companies were sharing customer data with the government. So we don't always know, and that sort of gets to the heart of why many people are concerned about privacy, because we don't know how our data is being used. To Robin's point, we don't know what companies are doing with data in many cases. Even if it's in the terms of services, it's often very complex or hard to find. So It's an open question in a lot of cases.
Robin, let me go back with you, and we kind of frame this show in a couple of different ways. One, that it's been about 3 years since Edward Snowden blew the whistle on the NSA. What has changed, I guess, within Congress or how the government is or isn't tracking people's information?
So I think a lot has changed since the Snowden revelations first started 3 years ago. First, we passed the USA Freedom Act, and this was a bill, now a law, that will stop the bulk collection of Americans' phone records under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, as well as under several other authorities. It's also significantly increased the transparency that the intelligence community is subject to, and it's increased the amount of information that even companies are allowed to share about these kinds of national security informational requests that they receive from the NSA and FBI. So I think the American people are able to know a lot more about what the government is able to do. I don't think that we're all the way there. Mm-hmm. I think that there are a lot of reforms that are still necessary, but certainly in the 3 years since the Snowden revelations first started, we've seen significant reform, and we have seen that the American people will rally to defend their right to privacy. We saw this most recently last week when an attempt by Senator McConnell and Senator McCain failed to attach an amendment to an appropriations bill that would have significantly expanded the FBI's surveillance authority. The members of Congress started receiving thousands of calls from constituents opposing that that attempt. And, you know, we see this in other contexts as well, like with regard to government hacking. Just last week, there was a major day of action that the Electronic Frontier Foundation kicked off along with my organization and other organizations and companies that will really push the government to start being more transparent about how it engages in hacking and criminal investigations, and push Congress to start asking the question of, is this action appropriate? And if it is, what kinds of privacy protections should be applied to that type of investigative technique?
Well, that kind of takes us back a month or two, Adrian, to this standoff between the federal government and Apple. This had to do with one of the San Bernardino terrorists' cell phone, or I guess smartphone. And there was some really interesting back and forth. What do you think was at stake in this case?
That was a fascinating story just because it brought together so many dramatic elements. But from a privacy standpoint, it was really, you know, it put Apple sort of in the spotlight for this issue that had previously been in a lot of ways more abstract, and really kind of showed how, you know, that privacy protections do have real world implications. Companies do have to decide what to give up and whether they give it up. And it's, you know, I think there's been some sort of skepticism from Apple in terms of how opportunistic perhaps their reaction was in terms of sort of facing off against the Justice Department. But it does show how privacy matters and has real implications for real people.
And it seemed, Robin, that the federal government in the end said, no, never mind, we'll take care of this.
Right. And that gets back to the whole idea where this is not just an issue about privacy. I mean, especially as it concerns encryption, whether it's full disk encryption or just encrypting the communications that you engage in over the internet. It's really our front line of defense against data breaches and other kinds of cyber threats. And so we live in a world where every day we hear about millions and millions of records being stolen from healthcare companies, from other types of companies, about ransomware and things like that. And at the end of the day, it's just critically important that we not only think of encryption as something that protects our privacy, but it's also something that protects our security and our economy. And I think that's something that in pursuit of breaking into the San Bernardino shooter's phone and trying to get Apple to undermine its encryption, they really didn't think about this as a cybersecurity issue. It seems like the FBI and DOJ were focused on it more as just getting into this one person's phone for this one case and not thinking through what the lasting effects would be. And that's sort of even more to the point because we've seen that they were able to get into the phone anyways by using a vulnerability. So it is that kind of thing where we should not only think of privacy as privacy, but because so much of our lives happen online and because we're so vulnerable to certain cyber threats, it's absolutely critical that we think of privacy and cybersecurity together because they really are becoming one and the same thing.
Adrian, going back to you and picking up on what we've been talking about here, and I just wonder, and perhaps this, I'm including myself in this as well, part of the public's reluctance to get perhaps protect itself the way it sounds like the two of you say we should do is that we don't really understand all this stuff, encryption. You know, we don't understand exactly how our cell phones work. All we know is that it does connect us to our world.
Right. And I think, I mean, and going back earlier, you sort of alluded to the convenience factor. And I think that's a big one. I mean, even in my own life, like if it's, I don't know, pouring rain and there's no taxis and you're late and you can get an Uber in 2 minutes, is that the moment where you're going to be thinking about how Uber has, you know, all of the records of where you go and when and whether you want that to be the case, or are you going to try to get where you're going right away? So we have all of these really remarkable tools and smartphones in particular are like these miracle devices. Yeah. And so the things we're able to do at any given moment can sometimes be more appealing than the consequences of what we choose to do with them.
Well, then I wanted to, Robin, you know, if we are being tracked or our activities, our behavior is being tracked, where does that information go? Is it being stored to be used against us? What is there a point at which all this data is just so overwhelming that it becomes meaningless?
So I don't think the data ever becomes meaningless. But I will say that there is a problem in that we don't know where it goes. We don't know exactly how it gets used. There's an entire data brokerage industry where you'll have these companies that will literally just buy this kind of data in bulk, like where people go, what kinds of websites they visit, what things they purchase online, and they'll use it, but it's totally unclear how they're using it, how they resell it. But to a certain extent, I think that that's where we need to start really paying closer attention. And so while it is hard and it's super boring to read your terms of service and things like that, and you maybe won't even understand it once you read it, it's something that will at least, if we start paying attention to it, it will make it really clear that we care about these things. Answering a question that a pollster gives you is going to give you a statistic about whether or not Americans care about their privacy. And I think it's pretty consistent that Americans do care about their privacy, but we've got to translate that into action. And so I think that's really where it becomes more difficult. But I think that's where we're going, not only because of the privacy implications, but as I mentioned before, the cybersecurity implications. People are going to start caring more about what happens to their data when they see how vulnerable their data could make them.
And we're almost having a break here. Robin, would you not use an Uber in the rain because for fear of tracking information?
I do use Uber.
Okay.
I use all sorts of online services, but I think that gets back to the idea where privacy is about autonomy. It's about making choices about how your personal information gets shared. And so as long as you're maintaining that autonomy, it's okay to give up some privacy. Not everything in your life has to be top secret. But you do, and I hope people do regularly, think about the implications of the choices that they're making with regard to their privacy and conscientiously choose to reveal certain information and then withhold other types of information.
Well, we're going to pick up on our conversation after this short break. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Adrienne LaFrance. She is staff writer for The Atlantic, covers technology. Robin Green, policy counsel for the Open Technology Institute at New America, talking about balancing things like privacy and security and technology and convenience. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. Robin, let me go back to you. And I was actually reading about the FBI's face recognition database. Apparently, they have something like 411.9 million images that I guess they have stored from various, perhaps off of things like Facebook. Maybe it's off of people's passports or driver's license. What do we need to know about this?
So I think the most important thing to know about this right now is it's a very large database, as you've just mentioned, that can include a lot of different people's photos of their faces. And at the end of the day, you don't have to be a convicted criminal. You don't even necessarily have to have been arrested to find yourself in that database. And right now, the FBI is pushing to exempt that database and all of the records in it from Privacy Act requirements, which would enable individuals to find out whether or not their photograph is in that database, how it potentially how it's being used or shared, although that's subject to certain exemptions already. And so it causes real concern within my community, and I would hope with Americans at large, because at the end of the day, you need that kind of transparency and accountability to ensure that the database is being used for its intended purpose and isn't being misused or abused. Or overused.
What do you think?
Accountability.
Sure, Adrian. What do you think about that? The FBI having 411 million images of people.
Right. I mean, I think Robin put it perfectly. Like, it's of great concern and should be of great concern to people, especially when there's no way to find out if you're actually in the in the database, or how that information might be used. That's alarming.
Let me get, looks like Tony from California to join our conversation. Hi, Tony. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for taking my call,
Marty. You're welcome.
And hello to all of your guests today. No, I mean, I think this is a huge issue. I mean, I think it's very important that we all need to understand who has this information, where this information goes, and where it's stored. There's a great movie called Terms and Conditions May Apply. Just everybody watch it. Facebook and all these, Google, I mean, they have just troves of where we click, where we go, what we research. You know, James Clapper, you know, he even lied to Congress saying that our information is not stored, but it is stored in these crazy data centers all throughout the country. And, you know, encryption is huge. People need to understand that, you know, but I think we've come to a time where we can't trust anybody or anything anymore. And we need to understand that what we click and what we search is being researched. And people need to understand that this is has huge implications down the road. And
sure.
That 1984 is here. It's happening.
Well, Tony, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Robin, you want to respond to Tony's comments and his concerns?
So I do think that there's absolutely cause for concern. I'm not sure that I think that you have to sort of stop interacting online in order to protect your privacy. I think that there are a lot of different options. If you are very, very concerned about your privacy, you can start using different tools like PGP encryption, which is like end-to-end encryption for when you're communicating like emails. You can seek out full disk encryption for your devices, which is what the iPhones now have. You can also use different anonymizing tools online, like Tor. So there are certainly options in order to better protect your privacy. It's hard to find something that's 100% foolproof. So that's not to say that everything will be 100% protected. But at the same time, it's like I said before, everything about privacy is about making choices about the kinds of information that you're comfortable with other people having. For some people, that is everything. Some people just don't really want to have their lives kept under lock and key in any way. And that's okay. But for those of us who do care about our privacy, who want to be able to make really distinct choices about what information we share and what information we keep private and how we share that information, I think it's really important that we start having a more public national conversation about how do companies treat our data. But even more importantly, because of the powers that government has over us, how does government treat our data? How can government access it and then use it or further share it? There's just not enough transparency yet, even though we have made some progress since Snowden. There's not quite enough transparency yet. And I think that that's sort of the next place that we really need to go.
Adrian, I've heard the argument, basically someone saying, look, I'm not breaking the law. There's nothing that I'm doing that's illegal. My life is an open book. I'm not going to worry about whoever is tracking my information. Is that something you've heard?
Yeah. And I think, I mean, it's sort of to Robin's point, too, that each individual should be able to decide what they're comfortable with in terms of what they're sharing. But again, that should be the individual's choice. So if you're opting in to share your location data, you should know that you're sharing it. It shouldn't be something where the government's kind of plucking it out of the ether without you knowing, or a company is plucking it out of the ether without you understanding how it's being used. So I think that people need, if we are to sort of gain any control over how our data is being used, we certainly, as a minimal step, should hopefully have a situation where we can ask, you know, what do data brokerage firms have on us? How are they using it? And maybe even, is there any way for people to opt out? Those are some of the steps that people in other countries can take because of regulations there. That's not something that people in the United States can do as of now.
Robin, we have to say goodbye to you, but just one final question. Are you surprised this hasn't become an issue on the campaign trail, especially the presidential campaign trail?
I think that it's going to continue to sort of bubble up. I do believe that once we sort of have officially the two nominees and have completed the convention process, that this is something we'll start hearing a lot more about in debates in particular. And I do think it's come up a little bit in previous debates, but I would just love to see the candidates really show a better understanding of encryption in particular and how it works and how it doesn't work. And one thing we know for sure is encryption's just math, and so you can't change math. So any calls for finding a way to guarantee law enforcement access and maintain strong encryption are sort of calls for finding a unicorn. It's just not going to happen as much as folks might like it to. So I'd love to see the debate shift away from that and towards a debate that's really more in earnest about what government authorities should be in light of the expanded use of encryption and what government should be doing to better consider Americans' privacy rights in light of the fact that everything we do is online now, and that so much more information about our personal lives, about our thoughts and beliefs and social associations or professional associations are just available. I think we need a new privacy regime that will protect our information given this new world.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you joined us today in Radio Times. Robin Green, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Policy Counsel for the Open Technology Institute at New America, Adrienne LaFrance, joining us by Skype, staying with us for the rest of the hour. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic, covers technology. And joining us now is Joseph Thoreau. He's Professor Associate Dean for Graduate Studies at the Annenberg School for Communication, and that's at the University of Pennsylvania, the author of several books, including The Daily You, and that was a book that he was a guest on Radio Times talking about. And Joseph Thoreau, nice to have you back with us on Radio
Time.
Hi, Maury.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. You talk about something called the privacy paradox. What is that?
Well, somebody mentioned it already. It's the idea that everybody, and surveys we've done, say they love privacy. It's important to them. And yet people give up so much information. And some people say, as somebody did here, that it's a trade-off issue, that people know they're giving up the information. Marketers love to say that essentially it's a trade-off. We give you something and you give us your data. We have found very differently that people don't agree with the idea of trade-offs in that way. They don't really like the notion of marketers giving them stuff in terms of they're taking information, but they're really resigned. We found that in a study that we did last year, 58% of Americans agreed with the following two statements, something like, I would love to have control over the information companies have about me online, and I've come to believe that I really have no control over that information.
Wow.
And we asked those statements were not put one next to the other. So, and I find this anecdotally, I don't know if you guys do as well, people say I have to do this. Like somebody said this about Facebook. You know, all my friends are on Facebook. I know Facebook is scarfing up all these data about me, but I have to be there. So it's really resignation rather than trade-offs, I would argue, that underpins what people are doing in the internet world.
But is it a sense of hopelessness or just this is the world that we live in? I want access to my family and friends on Facebook, and I'm kind of willing to live with the consequences, and that's just the world that we live in.
Well, I think it's partly hopelessness and partly I'm willing to live with the consequences, though most people have no idea about the consequences, and most people don't really know what choices they have. It's an amazing thing. The area that I study is commercial, not so much governmental.
Yeah.
But I would say, in respect to something you asked earlier, that the one reason the campaigns aren't talking about this very much is because they do it themselves. After the last presidential campaign, the Interactive Advertising Bureau actually brought politicians together to talk about how well the politicians did based on their ability to track people. And the implicit message was, you guys get something out of this. Don't make our life hard.
Well, and obviously people are donating money online, or they're, you know, tweeting out various comments about the candidate of their choice or whatever. And you're saying, Joe, that all this is being tracked and used for campaigns.
Yes, and they use exactly the same information bases and even more as the commercial people do.
I mean, it all sounds so depressing, Adrian. I have to say that. Right.
It can certainly be overwhelming. And I think, you know, there's an important point here being raised, too, that this isn't just the kind of data that we think of, to use the campaign example, that politicians traditionally would collect, like the party that, you know, with which you've registered, or the fact that you've donated money. I mean, that's like old school public record stuff.
Right.
We're talking about data that, you know, if you begin to think about what these data brokerage firms have and what probably the political campaigns have, they're putting together these really complex profiles of individuals that might include, you know, the fact that you once tweeted you're going to Whole Foods after work. And so from that little piece of data, they combined with everything else they know about you, they might assume a certain, you know, income level for you, which means you might get a certain campaign email that targets you for that reason. And so all of these interactions you're having online are based on these sophisticated data profiles. And so it's just, I mean, we don't know what they have, but we know they have a lot.
Yes, because it's clear, Joe, especially if you're shopping, you go to a site and then you go back to whatever you're doing. And next thing you know, there's an ad for that thing that you just look for.
Yes. And the phone that we all carry, the smartphone, which more than 70% of Americans use, is essentially a marketing technology. It's a marketing device. It's unbelievable what the smartphone can do based upon what you have in the store and what companies are doing with beacons and other technologies to reach you based upon literally where you are in the aisle. We're just at the beginning of this stuff, but you can get personalized coupons today based upon the specific location you're at in the middle of a supermarket.
We are talking with Joseph Thoreau and Adrian LaFrance about technology and surveillance and privacy and convenience. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Joe, is this then 1984?
No, it's not 1984, at least from my perspective, in the sense of some big brother looking down upon us. It's in many ways decentralized. Okay, there are a few huge players like Google and Facebook. And the reason they're so big and the reason they're so important, and there are a few others, marketing companies like Acxiom and Experian, is because Google and Facebook can actually see where you're going across devices. Facebook can follow you everywhere you go as you log in. And you probably know that more people use Facebook on mobile devices now than on the regular web browsers on their desktops or laptops. So literally, Facebook knows your location. And many other companies do as well. And I don't know if many of you or your listeners ever were in a situation where you get an app and the app says, can we use your location? Sometimes the app doesn't even have anything to do with location. But what they do is they sell your location to advertisers through these third parties. And so companies can really decide that they want to reach travelers at Philadelphia International Airport. And then give the travelers they think are important, the ones that they think have value, certain kinds of ads, certain kinds of messages, certain kinds of discounts.
Adrian, let me go back to you. And I remember seeing a picture of Zuckerberg within the last week or so. He was in front of his computer, probably on Facebook. But he had taped over the camera on his computer?
Mm-hmm. Right. I totally do that, too.
Do you do that?
Sticker.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And I know it's, you know, it can seem paranoid, but yeah, I mean, any sort of little steps you can take, in my opinion, whether that's opting out of an app that wants to use your location, or covering up your computer camera, or maybe not giving an app you haven't tried before access to the microphone on your phone. Like, mm-hmm. we're in an era where devices can be listening to us, which sounds conspiratorial and certainly sounds creepy, but that's the reality we live in.
That's exactly right. And in fact, there's a company that was trying, I don't know if they actually still do this, to listen to what you're watching on TV through your microphone,
right,
in order to send you ads based upon that.
Right.
Well, ads that would show up on your smartphone, Joe?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, and if you look at just the Amazon Echo, for instance, this device that's sort of a voice activated, almost like you can ask it the sorts of questions you might ask Google, or you can ask it to add something to your Amazon shopping list. That's a listening device. That's something that people are buying and putting in their homes, and it is designed to listen to you.
Joe, if an app or says, can we use your location, and you say no, do they abide by what we say?
Well, they have to. If they do, if they don't, it's illegal. Sometimes what they'll do, you have a choice of, do you want us to track your location just now, meaning it's relevant to what you're doing, or do you want us to track your location everywhere you go, which may not be relevant to what you're doing, and yet what they're doing is they're storing a whole lot of information. I think it's important to say, at least from my perspective, somebody might throw up their hands and say, so what? I mean, a lot of people, particularly when you talk about advertising and marketing, they'll say, what's the big deal? So they do this. From my point of view, we're entering an era where a serious kind of discrimination can be taking place with all this. I mean, this may sound funny and this is fascinating stuff, but it also means that more and more we're in a world where people's profiles begin to define who they are in the kind of public space of shopping. Shopping is what we all do. That's what we do. And essentially, people are being now profiled and given certain kinds of different prices. We're talking about discriminatory prices based upon profiles you have that you don't even know about. So these are major issues.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Joseph Thoreau, Professor, Associate Dean for Graduate Studies at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. And, Joe, I was reading you've got a book coming out, The Isles Have Eyes. Do I have that right?
Yeah, it's about sort of what I began to talk about, the changes in the retailing world. We all tend to think of online buying, and that is skyrocketing, of course. But most people don't think about the idea that 90% of all shopping still takes place in the physical store.
Yeah.
And stores are moving now to become like the internet in the store.
Well, I do want to pick up on that after this short break. Also with us, Adrian LaFrance, a staff writer for The Atlantic who covers technology. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Adrian LaFrance and Joseph Thoreau about privacy and technology, convenience, security, the world that we live in. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Adrian, let me go back to you. You wrote a piece in The Atlantic about driverless cars, quote, one big data gathering machine. Take us into that world. Go ahead.
Right. So, I mean, you can think about driverless cars as sort of an extension of the smartphone that many people are already carrying around. But when you think about the computer that will be required to power these vehicles, in addition to all of the potentially huge social benefits they pose, there's also this data gathering component. So the car will be keeping data presumably of where you're going and when. It may be integrated with your smartphone so that it's sort of linked up with all of your apps. So an example I give of in the piece that I wrote is you may be driving to work and the car can remind you, oh, like, let's go pick up your dry cleaning, or, oh, we just passed this restaurant you like, and what do you know, they're doing some sort of dinner special. So all of these ways in which your phone is tracking you will be ostensibly extended to the machine that may be driving you around.
Joe, I know even now, and I'm not the most technically sophisticated person in the world, anyone that knows me can tell you that, but I notice even when I get in my car now, I'll look at my phone and it will give me kind of a basic traffic report. Like,
yeah,
if I want to go to Philly, it's probably 43 minutes or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it'll tell you how long it'll take often. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, that's an important development that we'll see, and it's going to cause consternation, but also great stuff. I mean,
right.
the stuff about all of this is that it's hard not to use it. And I think I wouldn't be able to live without Google today. So I'm not trying to say that we're in a world that we should totally shut everything off. But I do think there are things that companies ought to be required to do in order to make the possibilities of sort of individual level discrimination less than they are today. I mean, we're moving into a world where literally people will be scored for their value, much as credit card companies do. And they will be given different prices and talked about differently. I argue in the book that it's much like it was before the middle 19th century.
Right.
We don't know, but selling products before like 1850 was a very different thing in terms of what you knew about people. And sometimes merchants would show people different products with different prices based upon what they knew about the person.
And
we're moving into a world sort of like that.
So the idea, let's say someone who's a wealthy person might be shown a different set of products, maybe even a different set of prices than a more middle-class person?
Yes, for sure. And the ideal began to change into the 20th century, partly for two reasons, which is really interesting. And one was Quakers, who owned a lot of merchant exchanges in the 18th century, 19th century, they actually believed that it was against their religion to charge different prices to different people. And when department stores developed, the department stores didn't trust their clerks to bargain. And so a straightforward pricing began to develop as a result of that. And we're moving into an era now where prices literally can change based upon who you are.
Hmm. Adrian, and which should be said, we were talking earlier about our computers perhaps watching what we're doing or perhaps listening to the TV shows that we watch. Also things like what coffee makers and other things are in a sense watching us or tracking us or somehow involved in our daily life.
Right. And increasingly, I think we'll see, just within the past couple of months, IBM patented technology for what's called a cognitive assistant. And this is sort of an extension of the concept of the Amazon Echo. So the idea is to have a device or perhaps not even a device. It could be sort of just like computing technology kind of waiting in the wings of your house to be able to swoop in and assist you. So maybe that's, reminding you of a family member's birthday at just the moment you're about to call them or noticing that, Adrian hasn't been as active today. Like, let's have whatever wearable device is attached to her wrist, check her pulse. Or, when you start thinking about the potential interactions between sensors and these sort of listening or tracking devices and this sophisticated sort of cognitive software, you have the potential to sort of quantify your life into all of this potentially really meaningful data, but also it means you're being tracked all the time.
I mean, it reminds me of things like when they talk about smart homes that are all sort of wired up. Yeah, Joe, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I was in an industry conference about 6 months ago where a guy started talking about, and he has this online actually too, he had a chart where he said that by 2024, 50% of Americans are going to have chips in their arms. And when they walk down the aisles of a supermarket, the supermarket will be able to tell, according to him, whether you're nervous about the price or not. And then he said, as a consequence, they will be able to, he said, lower the price based upon that. The thing that was amazing about it is the craziness of this. Nobody in the audience guffawed. Nobody in the audience said, what are you, nuts? And yet they all, and he had in his chart that by 2050, everybody would have a chip in their arms like this.
Wow. And I should say, you've got a forthcoming book. It's got a great title, The Aisles Have Eyes, How Retailers Track Your Shopping, Strip Your Privacy, and Define Your Power. Let me get Audrey to join us from Bear, Delaware. Then we got a bunch of comments as well. Audrey, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
I'm one of those rare birds that's not online, and I don't have a smartphone. And yet there's an amazing amount of my personal information floating around out there. I'm constantly contacted about things that I feel should be in the area of my privacy.
Oh, that's it. And is that through someone would call you, or how are you contacted?
People call me. I get information sent to me by mail. They know my age and everything about me.
Well, Audrey, I'm going to see what Adrian LaFrance has to say. Adrian, what do you think?
Right. So, and this can be a really disturbing experience, especially when you're getting solicited by someone who you would rather not hear from. And it seems that they know more about you than you can understand. There are all kinds of ways in which people are giving up data, even when they're not using a smartphone or going online. you know, I don't know if you've been in the had the experience of going to shopping somewhere and they ask for your email address when you check out, or they sort of just assume you'll give it to them, and you can say no. But that's the kind of thing where, you know, all sorts of interactions throughout our day involve data transactions. So giving up either your email address or your phone number, I think a credit card was mentioned earlier. So all of these sort of things where we don't necessarily always realize there's a data component attached to it, but often there is.
Joe, you want to add anything to that?
Well, the only thing, too, is that companies will often type you based upon where you live. So you can go, for example, go to Claritas Prism online and put in your zip code, and it will tell you based upon that what your neighborhood is like. And so marketers use that to decide whether to reach people with certain messages, not other messages. Banks decide to put banks in certain places based upon neighborhoods and their idea of who lives there and what they buy.
Audrey, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me read some emails here. One from Brian. He says, please say more about why we should care about online privacy if we're not criminals or spies. Seriously, I don't know what I should want to hide other than my credit card information, and I give that freely to hundreds of strangers every year anyway. Joe, I heard you exhale there. I'll give you a shot at it, and to you, Adrian, as well.
No, it is a really interesting problem because it's hard to convince people about this. It's easy to convince people about security in terms of identity theft. It's hard to convince people that having profiles about you more and more are going to affect the way you interact with the rest of the world, the kinds of discounts you get, the kinds of attitudes companies have about you. I was talking to one big retailing company, a marketing person there, who said when they see that someone is buying less, they will give that person a better discount than their most loyal customers in order to keep them. So that they continually will look at who you are. They will value you in different ways. And I have heard people who say, well, I'm going to change my habits based upon what I think is necessary in order to get people to think I have good data.
But Adrian, we touched on this earlier, and it's sort of been throughout our conversation here. I mean, if someone has not paranoia about their data, but just some concerns, are there things to be done that just give us a better sense of our private information is more secure?
Right. I mean, there are small steps people can take. You know, I don't even read the full terms of service agreements for every app I use. Like, I totally understand that there are some times where it's just like, who cares? This is convenient. I'm not going to deal with it.
Yep.
But I think at the very least, people should be critically thinking about the relationship between their behaviors online and offline, their data, and how that sort of mediates the relationship with the rest of the world. You know, this point about how it means your prices may change. There's also the question of it's not just that you might have to pay more for things, but eventually we may get into a territory where privacy is such a luxury that people are paying a premium to opt out, which creates a whole nother level of discriminatory practices potentially. So we should care because if the sort of buying and selling of data without the person's knowledge of what's even happening to their personal data is segmenting us as a society, that's a real concern. I mean, that's not just abstract. That should be concerning to people.
Absolutely.
Yes, AT&T is trying to do this now. They will say, if you let us use your data for advertising and tracking, we will charge you less money for the internet service than if you want to do it without tracking.
Wow.
Exactly. Wow. Joe, and to you, Adrian, as well, I think one of the, as a consumer, it's just the technology changes so quickly. It's hard, and perhaps this is even for law and for government to try to keep up with this advancing technology.
It's really difficult. And, you know, we tell people, clear your cookies. Cookies are not unimportant, but there's so many other ways for companies to track you. I do think that everybody should have some basic understanding of the internet, and I find that most people don't. I teach courses with undergraduates who are really quite smart, but they have no clue what goes on behind the screen.
It's not a series of tubes?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, it is and it isn't.
But then, right.
Another thing is that I think that we have to start praising and shaming publicly companies. I don't think journalists do a good enough job when they review websites and apps. I rarely see reviews of privacy policies. I think we have to try to get privacy policies to be not just kind of tough luck privacy policies. You mean you don't really have a choice. You either do it or you don't. I think there has to be some wiggle room in that way. So I think there's a lot to do. It's just really difficult.
Yeah. And privacy policies, Adrian, that people can read and understand.
Right. And that's a very important point, because some of these things are like 200 pages or just, I mean, like, I don't think I've ever gotten all the way through an Apple Terms of Service agreement, which is a terrible thing to admit because I'm a tech reporter.
Yeah.
Like, I should be reading these things totally. So it's
overwhelming. And they are contradictory. You know, they really are contradictory. You go to a department store privacy policy, for example, and I've read many of those, and they'll say, we don't sell your information. But down toward the bottom, they say, well, you know, we do have deals with third parties that can put cookies on your on your browser. Well, that's the same thing.
Absolutely.
No? Right.
So it's very, very complicated.
Well, you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Here's an email from Tib. I used to love responding to telephone surveys about political candidates. I no longer do. How do we really know if it's Quinnipiac or Annenberg or whoever, just because they say they are? Said the word Annenberg. Joe, do you want to respond to that? And
well,
we're in
please
political
respond
season.
To Annenberg surveys. But you're exactly right. I mean, we don't know who anybody is. I guess you could look at the ID on the phone if you have one of those. It's very complicated again. A lot of times marketers will call and they will make believe it's a survey when they're really trying to do persuasive communication. Surveys can be highly problematical. And yet academic surveys and some political surveys are terribly important for the discourse in our society. So I would hope that people can tell the difference, but I agree. We're finding it more and more difficult to get people who will answer our surveys.
Yeah.
And that's not just we, people around the country. It's a legitimate surveys are having much, much more difficult time getting people to answer for reasons the person just suggested.
Yeah, and Adrian, and we're almost out of time here, which is, I guess, that's sort of one way that the public feels that they can push back against what feels like intrusive surveillance.
Right. And I think Joe raises a good point that surveys conducted by independent groups or, you know, there are certainly occasions in which it's important for public discourse. But oftentimes online, you'll get anytime I buy something online, I'm asked to review it. And I usually don't, just because I don't necessarily want to put, you know, my information out there. So I think it's important for people to think critically about the questions they're being asked by anyone, really, at any time.
Well, and Joe, we're almost out of time here, but since you've got this book about the aisles or have eyes, when you go shopping, do you do something in particular to protect your privacy?
You know what I've begun to do, and this may sound counterintuitive, I've begun to use Apple Pay. Apple Pay is actually a better system than swiping your credit card.
Really?
Yeah, it has much more security than a regular credit card, which can be easily stolen. And, you know, I would say that one of the things we have to do, it's a little off your question, is stop the notion in restaurants of taking your credit card to the back and scanning it. It's an invitation to theft. In Europe, for example, they bring the credit card machine to your table.
Yes, they do.
There are a lot of things that go on in the U.S. that are highly problematical that way.
Well, we could go on. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Joseph Durow, nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks.
And Adrian LaFrance, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Joseph Durow, Professor, Associate Dean for Graduate Studies at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Adrian LaFrance, Staff Writer for The Atlantic, covers technology. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.